The content of this podcast could contain triggering information that may not be suitable for some listeners. Discretion is advised. Welcome. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and you're listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. In this episode, we'll be talking about resilience and healing through the arts. Resilience is the capacity to recover quickly from difficulties. However, recovering from trauma is not something that can be done quickly or overnight. In fact, I feel like recovery is a continuous process. But it's making the choice to seek help and pushing through the tough times, knowing that life is filled with adversity. That is what I consider resilience. No one can truly know how hard the work is until they are in the thick of it. And my next guest knows exactly what I'm talking about. Joining me is Melissa Dobbs, founder and executive director of the Metropolitan Fine Arts Center in Alexandria, Virginia. Melissa also works with Child Help, one of the largest nonprofit organizations dedicated to the prevention and treatment of child abuse in the nation. Melissa, thank you so much for joining me today on a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, we have so much to talk about here. My previous episode, I spoke with Child Help about the wonderful work that they're doing over there. And I want to get into the amazing work you're doing with them. But before we do, I wanted to talk about your story. And I wanted you to share your own experiences in your own trauma, because when you first talked to me about it, I was just struck by your resilience.
Thank you. So when I was 12 years old, I was sexually assaulted by a stranger in Annandale, Virginia, who followed me home from a grocery store to an apartment building we were living in as a family while we were building a new house. And he followed me home and found out where I lived. And then for the next couple of weeks, he was kind of courting me and getting to know me at this grocery store that my family frequented. And one day I was homesick from school and I got a knock on the door, and he was at my door. And I opened the door and he came in and he was talking to me, and one thing led to another, and a sexual assault happened on that day. But at the moment when it was happening, I didn't think that it was a sexual assault. I thought that that was a normal, appropriate way that a man would treat a young woman. And little did I recognize when I was 12 years old that a 24-year-old man was not appropriately doing that to you. So I really didn't tell anybody anything, kind of kept it a secret because I thought my mom would be mad because I let a stranger in my house, and I was embarrassed to tell them. I was worried that I would get in trouble.
Secrets are so hard. What did this do to you mentally?
Over the next 3 to 6 months, I started to develop a pretty severe eating disorder. I became bulimic. And it was the only way that I could handle the emotions and the feelings of abandonment that I felt. I felt like I was used and abandoned. Wow. And it was a really difficult feeling to grasp as a 12-year-old child. And so I started to eat a lot of food and purge it. And that was a release. It was like a physical somatic release for me to like get it out. And I kind of jumped into dancing. I spent a lot of time dancing. And I think dancing actually saved my life, because I think if I didn't dance, all of that trauma would be stuck in my cells. But I didn't know it at the time, but you know, dance kind of just helped me deal with it as much as I could.
Wow, that's amazing that dance gave you that outlet. A great distraction from what was happening internally, but the secret and pain was still there, right? I mean, I feel like people who have untreated trauma are ticking time bombs. Was there a time where you felt that?
3 more months of living in that apartment building. We moved out of there and into a new house in Fairfax Station, Virginia. And things just went from bad to worse. My parents couldn't drive me to dance anymore because it was too far away. So I only went once a week. And I started a new school. I was going into eighth grade at a brand new middle school. And I was completely lost. I just couldn't get it together. And mind you, before this incident, I was like straight A student, super responsible, kind of just a normal happy-go-lucky kid. And I started to not do well at school. I couldn't concentrate. My eating disorder really changed the chemical makeup of your brain. Mm-hmm. And so I started making some pretty irresponsible choices. And one of the big things that I noticed looking back is that I started seeking attention from boys. I really started to try to find another boy or another guy who mm-hmm. could kind of have that same experience with me, but really show me that it was love and not leave me. And so it turned into this really reckless mm-hmm. kind of like seeking for somebody to fill that void. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of, my entire mentality shifted. And, you know, ninth grade was my first year in high school. And literally, I remember the first day of high school being like, okay, I'm going to find a boyfriend. And like, I was not into this at all before, but it was just so important to me to fill this void. And so that just kind of became my priority. And I continued having an eating disorder. My parents had no idea what was wrong with me because they were just like, what they thought I was going through, like, you know, normal teenage mm-hmm. stress and strife. So ninth grade was so bad. My parents moved me to a different school for 10th grade, which was a performing arts school called Duke Ellington School of the Arts, which is amazing. It's a really yeah. prestigious school in DC, and kind of felt like it was my like new awakening and kind of a new beginning. And I got into dance class there, which was wonderful and very healing. And during that time, my bulimia subsided, actually. So it was like the first 3 or 4 months of the year that I was on track. I was getting back into school. My brain chemistry was better. And midway through the year at Duke Ellington, I had a bulimic relapse in mm-hmm. December. And that, alongside the fact that I was dating at the time another guy who was a lot older than me, and he broke up with me. And those two incidents triggered such a reminder of the childhood trauma.
Triggers or reminders of a past trauma affects the nervous system in such a way that, you know, it can be like reliving that trauma or being re-traumatized. How did you handle that?
I could not handle it. I couldn't take it. I was having panic attacks, and I ended up overdosing on hundreds of prescription drugs wow. in my house. I wrote suicide letters to my family. I wrote goodbye letters to everyone. And I just couldn't handle my life. I couldn't take being rejected again. I couldn't take feeling like I wasn't valuable or worthy enough again. And so I didn't have a way out. And I overdosed on some medicine, and I hid myself in a basement closet and took all of the things from my school. And so my parents thought I was at school, and the school, I guess, attendance officer called my mom the next day, and they were like, Melissa never showed up to school.
And this was the next day.
This is the next day. So they found me at 4 o'clock in the afternoon the next day, unconscious in my basement closet.
Oh my gosh.
And yeah, kind of scary. My dad kind of shook me when he got home, and I believe I took muscle relaxers, which I'm not sure why I'm not dead. That is honest to God's truth. I'm not sure why I didn't die, but you know, I'm super spiritual and I think God had a plan for me to help others get through their own trauma. So maybe that's why I'm here. But then, you know, they obviously take you to a psychiatric hospital. Mm-hmm. And so I was admitted into a psychiatric hospital and I was there for a good 6 months. And it was like the last 2 weeks I was there. I was in a group therapy session and I was just listening to these girls who I thought had it like way worse than me. They were like, yeah, it was sexually abused. And I was like, that's awful. And finally I told someone, I was like, hey, yeah. I mean, my first sexual encounter was when I was 12. And they were like, what? I was like, yeah. And they just started asking me questions. And literally the next day there was a detective in the hospital.
That's interesting. So you were there for 5.5 months before you realized that the abuse or the, I guess, event was actually abuse.
Correct. I never thought that I was an abused child. It never even dawned on me to think that it was an inappropriate thing for somebody to do.
Yeah. I mean, you were 12 and this was a man. And, you know, I feel like that is a really tough thing to figure out, especially if someone hasn't talked to you about relationships. Did you ever, I guess you were 12. I mean, did your parents ever talk to you about appropriate and inappropriate relationships at that point?
You know what? That's a good question. I don't think they did. I mean, I saw my parents, I saw that the model, but it wasn't a conversation that we talked about. It wasn't a conversation that anybody talked about.
Right. I mean, I think it's still a difficult conversation for people now to have, even though, you know, we're hearing from people from these organizations saying these are conversations that need to be had. So children, teenagers understand what's appropriate and inappropriate. So yeah, I can see how as a 12-year-old not understanding that, you know, especially if it's exciting a little bit, that you're getting this attention.
Absolutely. It felt like it was so flattering that someone like that would pay attention to me. And it really, it was interesting. Yeah, it was flattery. And it was done in such a concise and manipulative way that I can definitely see how predators identify and target their human trafficking victims. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the exact same thing.
You know, like myself and much like many people who have gone through trauma, especially sexual abuse, they start developing coping mechanisms that can be risky and manifest into a host of mental illnesses like the bulimia and sexual behavior. But did you think at the time that the cycle of risky behavior was due to the sexual abuse, or did you just think, oh, this is just who I am at the time?
At the time, I had no idea. I felt so lost. And like we were saying earlier, I was just reaching out to fill this void that I had. And it was almost like an addiction. Mm-hmm. It was an addiction to find that attention. And I had no idea what it was caused from. I just knew that that's where I was going right now. I had no clue why. But during the whole thing, I knew in my heart that I didn't want to be doing that. I knew in my heart that it was not the right thing to do. I didn't have the resources or the tools to get out of it.
I mean, you knew you just wanted to feel better.
That's right. I just wanted to feel better no matter what. I just wanted to feel better. Yeah.
When was it that you realized that you didn't face your trauma completely? I know that once they addressed you and said, whoa, that's not appropriate behavior. Did you get the treatment you needed after that?
I didn't get any treatment after that, actually. So I went to therapy once a week and I lied my way through therapy because I was really, really good at acting. And I was really, really good at making this therapist think that everything was okay. Because I was an articulate, driven, smart kid. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't want to be going to therapy. I just kind of wanted to be normal again.
What did you do to make yourself feel normal?
I engaged in some really risky behavior. I was hanging out with people far older than me, like 8, 9, 10 years older than me. Wow, in high school. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was normal. And my parents were like, what are you doing? Why? And I was like, oh, they're my friends. Like, we're friends. And, you know, looking back on it, oh my gosh, how seriously interesting is that? But long story short, my behavior ended very abruptly when I found out that I was pregnant when I was 18 years old. And the minute that I found out that I was pregnant and knew that I was going to be a mother, my entire psyche shifted to doing whatever was best to heal that child. Mm-hmm. And so this is kind of interesting. She's 21 years old now, but for the past 20 years, I've put my trauma on the back burner. And it has only been within the past, I would say, 3 years that I've actually gone back and really faced and uncovered what actually happened. And it wasn't until, sadly, some incidents in my current marriage that triggered some of the feelings of the trauma that I had when I was a child. It reawakened and reopened my life to go back and navigate some of those things.
Wow.
So it's only been the past, honestly, 3 years, three, 4 years that I've like started the healing process.
It's a long journey and it's really hard work. And, you know, I commend you for your bravery and courage to do it.
And it goes to show that you need to be truly ready to open yourself up to heal.
It is a tremendous amount of work. I have a very wonderful team of therapists and practitioners and just a great support from the community. And it's a beautiful thing once you start to heal. It's a really beautiful thing to know that you can actually finally feel whole again without nice. This void. It's literally like in your DNA. It's mm-hmm. in your cells. And
absolutely.
Once you start healing, it's funny. Once I started the healing process, some major shifts in my life started to happen. I mean, mega shifts started to happen. Like things that weren't serving me or were no longer okay to me anymore just shed. And I was able to create boundaries around myself and my feelings a lot better. So yeah, it's pretty fascinating.
Wow, that is amazing. It is like who you were pre-trauma.
Yeah.
Versus who you were post-trauma. And then it's like the healing process is going back to who you were before the trauma.
Yes, it's right. It's like going back to that inner child right before the mm-hmm. trauma. Yeah.
Speaking of inner child, once everything started falling into place, wasn't that when you began working with child help?
You know, the way God, spirit, source, the universe works, whatever you want to call it. During this period for me that I was really diving into this healing process, I was introduced to child help through one of my students at my school. And I started to go to child help, the village in Virginia, and I started teaching them to dance. And I started to see a lot of myself and the children there. And I started to see how dance really healed me. So it was kind of a nice way to tap into some of the feelings that I had as a child and to see how dance and movement is so supportive and healing, you know.
Did you create the Dance Academy, the Metropolitan Fine Arts Center, before Child Help?
Right. So Metropolitan Fine Arts Center was started 20 years ago. So it was my business, and then we turned it into a nonprofit school of the arts. And interestingly enough, the whole premise of that school was to teach children the performing arts in a safe, nurturing, and caring environment. And it's kind of like a mission of mine to make sure children are safe and nurtured and taken care of. Yeah, so that was way before Child Help. Child Help I was only introduced to about 3 years ago. And I wish I had the resources that are available at Child Help. I wish that more people know about the resources that Child Help has to offer mm-hmm. so that when circumstances like this happen, they can send their children to the residential treatment facilities there or get the services or have access to the services that they provide, because it is truly a transformational organization.
You know, they're amazing. And how did you get involved with Child Help?
So one of my students' fathers was on the board of Child Help. And he knows that I have a heart for children and that I love children. And we do this touring holiday performance called Santa's Frosty Follies. And mm-hmm. he said, you know, maybe you guys can go take this performance to the village at Child Help in Virginia. And I said, absolutely. So I drove out to meet the folks at Child Help about a month after we spoke. And I met this great guy named Wade. And Wade is the director of community relations there. And then the director at Child Health, his name is Chris Rubel. And the two of them took me on a tour. It's a 270-acre horse farm that is dedicated to treating children who have the worst of the worst cases of abuse. And you drive through this pastoral village and you see children being kids. They have bikes and they're fishing and they're going to school. And you see them walking with their therapists, playing basketball. You know, it's a child-centered healing environment. And so I went back in December and we did our first show there. We brought 75 students to perform. And after my students performed, the kids who were sitting in the audience, the Child Help kids, started coming up to the stage one by one and asking me to teach them to dance. And so I fell in love with them. I fell in love with the whole place. And so I stayed there for about 3 hours after the show that day. And we just had a huge dance party. And then after that, I arranged with them. I went back once a week, every Friday. And I taught anybody who wanted to dance. And it was some weeks, some kids came and some weeks different kids came.
I mean, that is really cool that you brought all of your experience, mental and physical, to join Child Help and help them out. I think that's just so amazing. That's just so courageous of you. What is your advice you would like to give to others who are struggling with their own demons and maybe their own trauma that they haven't addressed?
Never give up. Never give up. Life is always better than death. mm-hmm. Seek help, seek guidance, find somebody who can help you. Oh my gosh, kids need to know the Child Help Abuse Hotline like the back of their hand. I mean, they need to know that number. They need to know it. I would say my biggest piece of advice is never give up, though.
You're right. Even when you feel, because I know when I was a child and when I was going through all of the mess, I didn't feel that life was worth living. And it wasn't until I realized that I had to deal with some trauma that I didn't think anything about because I just wanted to lock it away, never think about it again, take it to my grave, but it will come out in other ways. So I think getting the help you can as soon as possible and, you know, reaching out to places like Child Help.
One of the amazing things about Child Help that I'm a super huge advocate about, they have a curriculum that they bring into schools. And their curriculum is called Speak Up, Be Safe. And it was designed specifically to educate children and teachers on the conversation we just had, where children don't know what's appropriate and what's not mm-hmm. appropriate. And I feel like that needs to be a curriculum that is almost a mandatory curriculum for children, because it's almost like, you know, like sex ed is at school, right? Just mm-hmm. a mandatory conversation in every school for every child about what is appropriate and what's not appropriate. And if it's happening to you, where do you get help? Where do you turn? So it's super important to me, I think, because if I had that resource, if I knew that, I may have had a different outcome, you know?
Yeah. Well, you are amazing. So
and so are you.
Well, thank you so much for joining me on a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. That was Melissa Dobbs, fellow Trauma Survivor Thriver, founder and executive director of the Metropolitan Fine Arts Center and dance instructor for child health. For more information about Melissa, the Metropolitan Fine Arts Center and Child Help, please visit atstpodcast.com. That's the letter A, tstpodcast.com. Thank you so much for being a part of the conversation. I'm Lori Lee Binstock, and you've been listening to a Trauma Survivor Thrivers podcast. Take care.